Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thunder Earthlets, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2080s Fiddlecast Lockdown Tapes. It is I, your host, Molchar, and I've relocated to a different part of the house where things are a little bit cooler because it's a bit much upstairs. But on this episode, we're going to be revisiting our chat with Ben Wheatley, the acclaimed, award-winning film director who is the genius behind A Field in England, Kill List, Sightseers. He's got a new film out. Felt like an ideal time to go back to the interview from a couple of years ago and rediscover the influence of 2000 AD on his work and what is very clearly a great love of the galaxy's greatest comic. So it was fantastic to revisit that. We'll be back, as always, in 7 days' time, where we're going to be chatting to some of the people behind a new collection, not from Rebellion, but from SecArt, which is a great website full of comics criticism. And this collection is called Judging Dread. So it's a collection of essays about Judge Dread that analyse the stories, look at some of the influences and draw some thoughts and lessons out of it. So I should look forward to talking to the editor and a couple of the writers behind that. So without much further ado, let's crack on, as always, and hear from Ben Wheatley from a few years ago about his filmmaking and his love of 2000 AD. So it's absolutely wonderful to welcome Mr. Ben Wheatley to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Welcome, Ben.
Oh, hello. Thank you for having me.
Our absolute pleasure. We're going to be talking sort of extensively about your influence, the 2000 AD's influence on your work. And I kind of wanted to kick off talking about High Rise, because that's the movie that's out at the moment, and yeah. I'm very much excitedly looking forward to it when a cinema in Oxford actually gets around to putting it on their schedule and I can go. So let's talk about a little bit about High Rise. You've talked in interviews about your love of J.G. Ballard. What was it like to be able to actually bring one of his visions to the screen?
It's slightly terrifying because he comes with quite a lot of there's a lot of fans of the book, and you want to, and also it's a kind of responsibility to bring such a big British sci-fi book to the screen, so you know you don't want to do it wrong. But at the same time, it's, you know, a massive treat as well. You know, I can't pretend it's not, you know. So it's two kind of sets of conflicting thoughts. You know, at one moment you're kind of going, oh brilliant, it's the text is so rich, there's so much in it. And then the other hand, you go, oh God, if we get this wrong. But this is the same for all films, you know. Once it's there, and it's there forever, you know. And they'll know, it will dog you until your dying day if he balls it up. So, yeah.
Did that pressure kind of translate into the filming? Did it make it more difficult? Was it a grueling shoot or?
No, I think I remember reading a thing that David Cronenberg said, and he said that, you know, the pressure of a movie is reduced down to dealing with it a day at a time. I mean, you have to break it into small moments, and then you deal with it a shot at a time. Because you can't hold the whole weight of it on you, otherwise you would be paralyzed, you know, you wouldn't be able to make a decision about anything. So I think it's you just do it bit by bit, and you just hope that the kind of the strategies and ethos that you have set at the beginning of the project will pull you through it and make sure you do it right. So it's very small decisions made very early on to make a massive difference going through the project, really.
And in terms of your process, was that any different? Because I read a quote from Elizabeth Moss, I think it was, who said that
she thought that your process was still the same, but you'd just got more resources for this. So you were kind of, you know, there was a bit more money, there was more kind of people around, but at the same time, you kind of did what you did, which is, you know, how you make movies.
Yeah, I don't think you can do anything else, you know. Otherwise, I think if you completely change your process, then you end up being somebody else in a way. I mean, you know, it's the only way I know how to make stuff, and it's been kind of borne out from making a lot of movies in the last few years, and that's the way both I like working, and Laurie Rose, the DOP, likes working, and Amy Jump, the writer and editor, likes working. You know, that seems to be a comfortable place for us. So yeah, she's right. I mean, it wasn't any different from the other movies, except we built a load of sets and had a much bigger cast. I mean, that was the main. You know, that's the main difference, is dealing with a big ensemble cast is a challenge in itself. And, you know, a nice challenge, but still it's not, it can't be taken for granted, you know.
You mentioned Amy there, and she wrote High Rise, indeed, as, you know, long-term collaborator. How does that process work if you're used to working with somebody who you've worked with before, and how does that come out in the kind of director-writer relationship?
Well, I think there's lots of different. I think the thing about film is there's no rules really, you know, to how you work creatively, and I'm sure that's true of most mediums in a way. There's assumptions people make about it, and they're usually born out from how we experience it from cinema. So, you know, you think that the one I always think about is Death Trap, the Michael Caine, Christopher Reeve movie, where they, you know, they're meant to be like writer collaborators, and they have this kind of office with these two typewriters, and they write and talk and throw ideas across the room and then type it in, and it's all, you know, it's this kind of marvelous world of mutual collaboration, and it's just exactly not how that I work with Amy, you know. So our process is much more, you know, on a script that she's written entirely herself. I don't even see it, you know. She just goes off and does it and comes back and it's done. And I think that there's a thing where directors are given a lot more credit in some ways than they're due, you know. And I think this is down to the French, essentially, with their kind of auteur theory. I think certainly some directors are, you know, throw their weight around, but my relationship with her in terms of the director writer relationship is a lot more delicate. It's not, you know, I'm not interested when she's written a script in stamping my thoughts all over the writing of it, because she's written it, and if, you know, if I was a better writer than her, then maybe I'd have written it, but I'm not. So it's like, it's pure egotism to just start, you know, flinging it about and saying, well, I'm not doing that, you know. And I think that's, and I take a massive pleasure in working from her scripts, because they're so great, I think. So, you know, I think that's, I think there's an assumption that the director has to have a fiddle with everything. And they don't always, you know, sometimes they do. And also, you know, we work together as collaborators as well, and that's a different experience, and that's a different way of working for us. But certainly when it's been a script that she's written entirely, I don't tend to mess with it, and I just get down to the business of translating that onto the screen.
I know what you mean about the perception of directors as being, you know, the almost tyrant of the cinema. Watching Hail Caesar, the Coen Brothers movie, where the all the communist writers are kind of gathered round, going, well, you know, we've won multiple Oscars between us, but do we see any, you know, is it that idea of these poor sort of downtrodden writers who kind of offload their work onto somebody else who gets all the credit for it?
Well, it's a different thing. That, I mean, I think that the Hail Caesar world, that kind of 50s Hollywood world, is a world that kind of doesn't exist so much anymore. I mean, that's more of industrial filmmaking, where you know, it's led by the studio boss, and then, you know, and then they're kind of, their commission, you know, everyone's on the contract, and then they're being told what to do to a degree. Now, there can be auteurs within that system, but mainly it's all being drawn together by one person, like the studio boss is at the top of that pyramid. And that kind of exists more or less to a degree in television now. or in the bigger kind of, or still in the big studio films. I mean, certainly in the Marvel movies, that seems to be the case, that there's, you know, they're all drawn together by one man, and then people are kind of brought in to fit roles to make the different movies, but they're being led. It's like a, in the same way that the, you know, that there might be a showrunner for an HBO program. It's a similar kind of thing.
Why make High Rise now? Because Ballard is a fundamentally dystopian writer who you know uses the alienation of modernity and all this and the other to explore the breakdown in human relationships. Why do you think it was important for you to make High Rise at this point?
Well, I mean, it's you know, people are saying it's a dystopian novel, but we're in a dystopia, it feels like. That's the problem. It's like, and then the issue with Ballard, what was interesting about Ballard, I thought, was that when I read the books in the kind of late 80s, they were predictive science fiction. But now they're not. Now they just kind of sound like they're pulled from the newspapers, you know, to a lesser or greater degree. You know, I certainly think High Rise does. And it's slightly more disturbing if any of the other books start to become more and more realistic. So yeah, I think it felt like it, you know, it was of the moment. But then it kind of, then the idea to set it back into the past and to make it a weird kind of period film that's a science fiction movie at the same time, was that there's certain elements of the book that are kind of just broken now, like the idea of, you know, that if you set it now, you'd have to deal with social media, which is kind of, you know, even though the elements of social media are in the book, you know, there's a lot of filming of stuff by the characters and projecting of stuff on the walls and that kind of thing. But the idea that you could have a tabloid where no one, that they could go quietly mad in the corner of London somewhere and no one would know about it in the world of Instagram doesn't really work, unfortunately, anymore.
Mm.
But I do like, you know, I think the idea of, like, if you put stuff into the part, you know, any movie that's a period movie or any movie that's a science fiction movie is just kind of a way of talking about now anyway, or should be.
Mm.
But within the, you know, within a bracket of dislocation, so that you can talk about things now without having to sound like you're hectoring the audience to a degree.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about it as science fiction, because so many people forget that Ballard is at heart a science fiction writer. You know, he is talking about the future. He is talking about this dystopian world. What appeals to you about Ballard's kind of science fiction?
Well, I think that the thing about Ballard for me is that we all exist in a kind of a bubble of a smug bubble of society where we think everything's going great and we all kind of think we're going to live forever and we think that we're in the cutting edge of modernity and not in the moment and we're the greatest human beings that have ever existed. You know, we can't help it. And we kind of reach out to the society that's happening around us and kind of perpetuate this idea. But Ballard had seen it. You know, he'd been in his own childhood, he'd seen the complete collapse of civilization, and he'd seen it going from a position of like being, you know, in a house, upper middle class, in a house with loads of servants and stuff, to being in an internment camp. And he saw how delicate and how precarious everything is, and how that, you know, literally that society can be like a stage play, as a set, you know, that could be suddenly collapsed around you and broken down. And I think that that gave him the ability to see through a lot of the things that we take for granted, and it bears out. His writing, it's almost like he has an X-ray vision that he can see through our society and see to something else that sits underneath it.
I mean, that's fascinating. There's so many characters in his books that have a remarkable amount of hubris and pride, and sometimes he almost takes great delight. You kind of feel the sense of great delight in taking these people down, about humbling them and reducing them down to their basics.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that about High Rise, that he was just full of, he got, took all the people he didn't like and stuck them in a building and then punished them horribly.
Well, I mean, High Rise is the perfect way to talk about your interest and connection with 2000 AD, because I've read interviews where you've directly referenced 2000 AD and Block War, Block Mania, the idea of cramming people into these giant structures. Let's talk about reading things like Block Mania when you were a kid. I mean, how old were you when you were reading 2000 AD?
I'd say I was probably about 8.
Right.
Okay. I probably could do the maths and get it wrong. I was born in 72, so if you can do quickly add that up. But the first issue I bought was 236, the first prog,
which is
the beginning of Block Mania.
Mm. Wow, what a moment to start.
I know. There's two issues that are really super important to me. It's that one and also 89, which is the beginning of the day the Lord died. And I would have been, that was the first one I read as a kid.
Mm.
And that would have been in like a, and I remember it vividly. I was in infant school and it was raining. And when it rained, we were all locked in the sports hall and the comics would come out. And I remember picking it up off a table and reading it. And that, it's so insane that I can remember that. And when I bought, and I never owned that copy until much later on. And I remember finding it, probably until I was like 40, to be honest, which isn't good. But, you know, I remember picking it up and having an incredible rush of not just nostalgia, but kind of understanding of where, you know, that literally reading that one comic had kind of defined a lot of things in me. You know, it's got incredible sick humor in it. It's got a very strong episode of Flesh in it as well, if I remember. And it's very violent, you know. And I think those two things made a great impression on me, but I didn't really collect. I didn't really collect it until 236. That was the first issue I bought. I bought it into 500 after that.
Right. Okay. And I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because there's a competition that's just run in the newsletter that we do, the email newsletter. Because we're coming up to Prog 2000, I've kind of loaded up all the covers from a particular year that corresponds to the prog number. So like 1978, I've done all the 1978 progs and sort of asked people to give us a reason why their favourite is their favourite. And it is essentially an inbox full of people having an almost forensic memory of the time that they picked up that issue.
Yes.
So yeah. You know, and
so vivid.
Yeah. And I'm the same. You know, I can probably draw you a picture of the newsagents when I first got a copy. But I mean, that sounds like it was a formative moment.
It was, and those first probably six progs after that, and then into Apocalypse War were, I mean, I was so lucky. I mean, it's such a brilliant run, you know. And then also when you go back, it's almost like that's almost like a full stop, isn't it, on the Dread story from prog one to the end of the Apocalypse War. You could just take that and say that was, you know, that's a full era, proper heavy era. And also then to have on top of that Strontium Dog and Rogue Trooper and Ace Trucking and Nemesis running all at the same time was it was pretty huge. But I think it, you know, I felt that I'd read there's stuff in Apocalypse War which is so dark as a children's comic, it begs belief, you know, that was acceptable to give to little kids, you know, like Dread executing collaborators is quite unbelievable. You know, and characters just sacrificing, you know, just committing suicide all the time, you know, like jumping off the, you know, cutting through the the overpass with the stub gun, and he does it, and the character does that. He just is really cheery about it, and he's watching, going, reading it, going, "Ow, what's this about?" You know. So yeah, I think there's loads of it, but it's just so interesting that when you look at the kind of kids' comics now, and you just think how. Or just the level of sophistication in those comics and anarchy that I just can't imagine it happening now. It's, you know.
That's a point I'm going to come back to in a minute, because there's a very interesting quote that I dug out. At this point in your life, how did 2000 AD, Judge Dredd, Strontium Dog, Rogue Trooper, Nemesis, how did these things kind of bind everything else together? What were the other kind of things that you were absorbing at the time?
Well, I think the thing is, and comics have been like this for me for a lot of my life, is that science fiction cinema can barely keep up with comics, because the ideas in comics, because of the production cost of a comic, is so low in comparison to a film. And you know, all the way during that period, there'd have only been Star Wars and maybe Blade Runner, but I would have seen Blade Runner much later on, and maybe Escape from New York or any of those kind of Italian barbarians movies were as close as you'd get to 2000 AD, and Terminator later on, I guess. But that's not many things when you consider the output of 2000 AD every week, like three or four stories, all very different. And I think that would have led my, you know, that would have been the most important bit of my kind of science fiction input. And like the movies were just like tentpole things that happened every few years. You know, they certainly weren't as important as the comic was. And I wasn't a great reader. I mean, I would have read like, you know, the Ballard stuff and Philip K. Dick and all that kind of stuff. But 2000 AD was the main thing I was looking at, I think. That and Doctor Who, I suppose.
That's a hell of a kind of British diet of science fiction.
Yeah, was it Tomorrow People, Doctor Who?
Yeah.
You know, the tripods, you know, it's all that kind of stuff. But it's never, none of it is as vicious as 2000 AD. Yeah. You know, 2000 AD, even if you translated any of those stories from those comics, from that run from 236 onwards, it was, you know, that would still be cutting edge sci-fi cinema now, I think, if it was translated directly.
We had science fiction author Lauren Bucus and her collaborator Dale Halverson on the previous episode, and they're both South African. And for whatever reason, 2000 AD was the only comic that they could get regularly. So I think Dale sort of lived in this tiny town on the coast of South Africa in the middle of nowhere, and he had this amazing comic come through, and they talked a bit about how things like Strontium Dog, you know, if you're living in an apartheid system, even as a white person, you know, Strontium Dog is incredibly powerful stuff.
Yeah,
and things like Halo Jones as well. If you know you're a young kid who just lives in a boring town and wants to get out and do something interesting, what message did you pick up on as a kid? I mean, where did you grow up?
In Essex. So I was in Billericay, which is a kind of commuter town out near Basildon, Newtown. So, yeah, I mean, it was, there wasn't a local cinema. The nearest cinema was in Basildon, and that was, we never went. You know, that was, you know, I saw Star Wars. That's about it. So I didn't see Empire Strikes Back until I was like 22.
Wow.
It was shocking, really. Or any of those. I mean, I think I remember seeing Indiana Jones on a VHS, you know, on a pirate tape. So he kind of missed all that stuff. It just didn't happen. And we had American comics, but very late on. You know, I think I got that, what issue is it? 232 or something of X-Men, which is the John Byrne run.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Of with Wolverine and the end of the Jean Grey stuff. And I remember getting that and some Alpha Flights, but that was about it, you know, and they were extremely expensive as well. So it was kind of my only the only time I, you know, there was no back issues. You couldn't get anything. You know, the only time you could get back issues was from going to the dentist. You'd get the occasional comic and you'd have to steal it. So my collection, my 2000 AD collection, you know, that was before 236 was kind of nicked from dentists' waiting rooms. So I had about 6 or 7 issues. And that was really painful because you'd read things like, you see the VCs or something and go, oh my God, there's a whole story here and I'd get one bit, tiny bit of it. Or I'd get a hint of the Judge Child, a little bit of Judge Child and go, oh, you know, and you'd never get further back than that. And then occasionally you pick up that really sweet run of the 2000 AD Star-Lords, which had the really nice covers because they seemed to survive more before they went back to the crappy paper again. So that, you know, and I picked up a couple of those and they were just amazing. But yeah, and then I think I was probably about 9 when I got taken to Forbidden Planet for the first time as a kid.
Well, that must have been quite a utopia.
It was unbelievable. It just completely blew my mind. And again, I can remember it. It was the Denmark Street to Forbidden Planet, and I didn't even know what I knew was that I was going to buy a lot of the Titan reprints. Mm. And I didn't buy anything else. Didn't buy even any American comics. It was really bizarre, seeing as I was there, right there, you know. Mm. But it was, that was just to get my hands on those Titan books was super important to kind of get the continuity from Cursed Earth through and get Cursed Earth and Judge Child and Judge Caligula. So I bought all those and then read them in one big lump.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There was a 15-year gap between me reading the first half of the VCs and me reading the second, because I got the first Best of 2000 AD monthly that had the first lot of the VCs in, and then never saw the second. So it took me a very long time to track.
Oh yeah, me too. And I recently bought Meltdown Man, and I'd only ever read one or two issues of that. Bought the whole book of that, and then it was and I remember going to a friend's house, or a new acquaintance's house when I went to senior school, and reading all of the ABC Warriors, which I'd never, and stayed up all night reading that stuff, and dug out his whole, he had a massive collection. And also reading weirdly the Blade Runner Marvel adaptation, and not having seen the film. You know, it's all the wrong way round. Everything's upside down at that point, when things weren't available, impossible to get hold of, you know. Mm. So yeah, it was. It's very interesting, that stuff. And I suppose I would have seen. Yeah, I remember getting Star-Lord as well around that period. Mm. So I'd read some of those, which were really excellent. And then the other comics we would have read would be Commando and Victor, because one of my uncles collected Victor.
Right.
So I'd read thousands of issues of Victor. It's just ridiculous, Victor. You know? And Doctor Who comic as well. So that big run of like Gibbons and Moore and McMahon stuff on Doctor Who, I read all that in one big lump. I think I swapped a Action Man or something for a complete run of Doctor Who UK comic.
it kind of sounds like you were raised by Pat Mills, John Wagner, Alan Grant, Jerry Finlay Day, et cetera, et cetera. Like, this was such a major kind of part of your...
Yeah, totally. And I drew exclusively Judge Dredd as a kid, a lot, all the time, on every school book. And then I traced all of the Nemesis stuff, meticulously traced it off the comics, just because I loved... is the O'Neill's lines, you know. I just love that. I mean it's that him and McMahon, I couldn't get my head around the art because it seemed so alien. I'd never seen anything like it, and especially I remember looking at the pages of Block Mania, the couple of issues he drew before he had to stop, and just couldn't figure it out. And I was looking and going, this is insane, I've never seen anything like this. So beautiful. And then when I got to like look back at his work and see it develop up through that, and then through into Slane, it's one of the great joys of comic book art, I think, that development of that style. So yeah, you know, and I just found that really beguiling, and that's what makes it stand out. 2000 AD is that those kinds of that the artists were let loose. Mm. Yes, I mean, Nemesis doesn't make no sense at all. That early run. And I remember as a kid trying to work out what the hell was going on. It looked so amazing, but it doesn't. Just couldn't get my head. What, you know? I suppose I came into it like halfway through, and because there'd been a gap, hadn't there? There'd been a gap, and it almost run. I guess they just couldn't keep up with the art at that point, and there was like a. It come back halfway through the story during Rockmania.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just bonkers. You know, they're already in an underground somewhere or being burnt alive or something. And then, anyway, so yeah, but I just loved it. And it was the idea of trying to unpick it was interesting. I mean, Road Trooper made no sense to me either. I couldn't, without knowing the beginning of it, you're just going, what's going on?
And that's one of the most straightforward plots in of all of 2000 AD. He's off to kill one man.
But you go, what? But if you come into it halfway through, you go, what? They were all killed. Why? What? Yeah, like, and I remember the shock of seeing the issue, you know, I didn't realise he had blue skin. And I think also the other thing is I thought he was called Rouge Trooper for a long time. But that's just my not being able to read properly. And the Eclipse War as well. It was about 2 years before I went, oh, it's Apocalypse. Oh, that's different from an eclipse, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it's good that 2000 AD helped your reading comprehension when you were a child.
That's absolutely, yeah. It was fundamental.
is there anything of Block War, Block Mania in High Rise?
I think so. I think that it probably led me to High Rise, to the book, as much as anything. And now, that's a chicken and an egg thing, isn't it? It's like, what did High Rise itself influence Block Mania? Who knows? Mm. Feels like it could have done, but then it's certainly an idea that's in the air, isn't it? Because around that period, because Shivers is very similar to High Rise as well, so and the kind of that 2000 AD seems to be that clash of science fiction and punk anyway, so it's not, I could imagine it could exist in the same, in the ether, you know, and come together, but I felt like that there was elements of Ballard in 2000 AD around that period.
Well, it's science fiction is always influenced by the worries and the stresses of the day, and yeah. in that kind of late 70s period, you had the first real kind of sense of overpopulation.
Yeah,
that, you know, things were reaching a kind of tipping point where people were being crowded into these mega cities.
There's Harry Harrison as well, isn't there?
Yes.
Make room, yeah. And, you know, and then, but then he appears in 2000 AD. He's obviously someone that they're kind of looking at, because then he appears with his Stainless Steel Rat book. So it's kind of, it's interesting. That's a kind of anomaly, isn't it? Stainless Steel Rat within 2000 AD.
Yeah, we've not done many adaptations, and the ones that we have done, excluding Stainless Steel Rat, have been kind of movie linked, successfully or otherwise. But the Stainless Steel Rat stuff is still very well regarded. You know,
I think it's excellent. Yeah, I loved it when it was on.
Had you read the books?
I read the books after reading it in 2000 AD, and right, it's very close to the books. But then I love this Gezira art. Have I pronounced that right? It's always a shock.
Esquerra.
Esquerra, yeah, that's it. I called McMahon for most of my adult life. So, you know.
I'm seeing a running theme here.
Yeah. So, but that art was just phenomenal. You know,
I mean, what were you going to say?
Fiends of the Eastern Front as well. It's a great favourite of mine, and that's a kind of anomaly as well, isn't it? Because that really should have been in battle.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a kind of classic Jerry Finley Day. Take a war story, file the serial numbers off of it, and then add sci-fi, fantasy, or horror as applicable, which is, you know, an amazing formula, and you know, some of the most classic series we've ever featured have been because of that. You know, that's actually one of the perennial favourites that people ask a lot about, like them. In the it's
Harry 20 on the High Rock as well.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But it's kind of like that was such a period of even in 2000 AD, which has always been inventive and eclectic and diverse. That period that you were reading seems, you know, is the classic sort of golden age period where whatever formula was working at the time was working incredibly.
Yeah, and it's almost what I find really interesting about 2000 AD is that when the brain drain happens and they all kind of bit by bit leave, they then reinvent American comics completely. And eventually what happens is they reinvent cinema.
Yeah.
So, you know, this whole thing, no one really talks about Mark Miller and the how he's basically recreated the Marvel Universe, and then that becomes the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It doesn't really get said a lot, and it's really bizarre, you know.
Hmm. Have you seen the Future Shock documentary?
Yes.
What did you think of that?
Yeah, great. I mean, the more that people talk about 2000 AD, the better. As far as I'm concerned. And the book's good as well. What's that?
Thrill Power Overload.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously, I was a bit disappointed to read about all the fucking ins and outs of it and the controversies and stuff, but you don't really want to know about any of that stuff. You just want to hear about the, you know, how it was all great. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's... For those who know about it, it's kind of fundamental, you know, the importance of it. But then, and it's weird that people don't talk about it more, but I don't know. I guess it's because I think there's always a thing about it being a kid's comic, essentially, and that people are a bit snobby about that. I mean, that all changed in the late 80s, didn't it? But there's still people are a bit funny about it.
Well, I mean, that brings us nicely on to action. Because I read a fascinating piece, I think it was in Time Out, where it was objects that inspire the look of High Rise.
Yeah.
And one of those was a copy of Action Comic, specifically the Kids Rule OK cover that got Action effectively banned and then neutered. And in that you coming back to what we were talking about before about the kind of comics that you would put before children now, you said, I've been reading comics with my son, and you realise how anodyne culture for kids is now. I mean, that was kind of, you know, questions in the House of Commons were asked about that comic.
I know, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's amazing that could happen. I mean, the other thing I was looking at was I bought some old Eagles, you know, I bought an Eagle from 58, I think it was. And it was saying, it was an episode, you know, Dan Dare, you know, next week Dan does something, I don't know, he kind of fights the Treens or something like that. And then I was looking at like an episode, a copy of 2000 AD from 77. And it was, oh no, I think it was like 68. Did it run that late, Eagles? 68?
It wasn't around for
67 or something. Anyway,
yeah.
Something like 10 years different. And there was a Strontium Talk episode. And it was next week, Your Next Scum. I thought, yeah, it really changed quick, didn't it? It was really wholesome, and then it just wasn't. And then I was rereading the Dan Dare, you know, the reprints.
Yeah.
Just done. And you know, that first episode, he murders someone to bunk on a ship. And you're like, hang on. What's this all about? It's just despicable. You know, I didn't notice it at the time, you know, because he was one of the Dare strip was a bit... you know, not to go with the theme of me not understanding stuff, but that was one of the more confusing strips in 2000 AD when you weren't, I don't know, there was something, it felt like slightly out of step with the rest of the comic often, that one.
Well, you had that amazing Ballardinelli artwork, you know, yeah, like living axes and ships that were alive and things like that, and it's just it's like someone's brains have just splattered all over the page, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what was going on with him that they, you know, all his strips were brilliant like that. I mean, the Ace Trucking was the one that I guess I must have read live, you know, that was part of that run.
Yeah.
And like I said, I only came to Meltdown Man later. And what was the slave one? What was that called?
Black Hawk.
Black Hawk, yeah. Yeah. I only saw tiny bits of Black Hawk, but they all seemed to exist in the same universe because his art seemed to just join everything together, didn't it?
Mm. He passed away a few years ago, and it's strange to look back at his artwork about how utterly different it was to everybody else. Because, you know, you look at Dave Gibbons and he's amazing, but it's a British comic book style. You look at Kev O'Neill and it's insane, but it's still recognisably British. But then you get Ballardinelli and it's just... I mean, yeah, as you say, don't know what his thing was, but...
It doesn't even fit within European comics, really. I mean, because you've got Redondo, is it?
Redondo, yeah.
Redondo, yeah, and that's kind of... It has that Spanish-y style, you know, and you see that on the continent. There's stuff that's like that a bit.
Mm.
And then you've got... This is going to be a litany of me not remembering anybody's names now. And then you've got, like, what's his name? Who's the guy who did Road Tripper?
Colin Wilson.
Well, Colin Wilson, yeah. And again, his is like, it's a bit like Blueberry or something.
Well, yeah, he ended up drawing Blueberry for many years.
I mean, that artwork was incredible. I mean, what I used to love about that was it's very similar to, you know, that concept art you used to get from Ford.
Hmm.
About what the future of cars would look like, and, you know, and it had that feeling too. And it was very incredibly technical, but again, it wasn't something that you hadn't seen before, kind of. But yeah, some of the art. I mean, going back to McMahon, it's like that. Apart from the very early stuff that was on purposely like the Dread concepts, but as his work developed, it's just so crazy.
I mean, talking about anodyne culture, I mean, what's your opinion about, I mean, superhero films? And, I mean, you mentioned Mark Miller there influencing the way that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has looked, but it's still a very American way of dealing with stories and, you know, like no, there's no blood and... you don't necessarily see the people who are being crushed beneath these giant buildings that are falling on them.
Yeah, well, that's a different thing, isn't it? That's something they're coming to come to terms with a little bit that no one really saw coming, that it would be distasteful to them. I mean, 2000 AD is equally guilty of that. So, I don't know. You know, it's a bit mean to single them out for that one. I think that's something that surprised everybody because it's like, well... It should be fun blowing up buildings, you know, in cinema. It should look fun, but it doesn't, I think. I think obviously everything changed after 9/11 and everyone got to see what an actual real big building blowing up's like, you know. Mm-hmm. So it suddenly goes from being something that's spectacle to being slightly morbid and horrible, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I've got my ticket booked for Civil War. I'm going tomorrow, and I'm excited about it. But I think that the whole Marvel project's really interesting because it's like they've turned cinema on its head and turned it into, you know, like the world's most expensive TV season. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a series, but it's really back to the original ideas that Stan Lee had in the 60s of making a soap opera out of the characters, and they're all interlinking and those stories all living in New York. It's all exactly the same as it was at the start, which is great, you know. But I think that there's room for all sorts of different types of storytelling, you know. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, I went to see Batman Superman and I enjoyed that as well. And I could understand what the fuss was about, why everyone was so cross about it. because it seemed to me like the greatest hits of all that Batman stuff I really liked in the 80s, you know, kind of. And to complain it doesn't make any sense is nuts, because it doesn't make any sense. Of course it doesn't. You know, it's like, what? Who is the only person in Gotham City who's afraid of bats? It's Bruce Wayne. You know? So why would he dress as one to fight people? How is that going to be frightening at all? Anyway, we digress.
Considering all this influence from 2000 AD on your psyche and the kind of things you like, what would a Ben Wheatley superhero film look like?
I don't know. I mean, probably like Martial Law.
Yes. Yes. You heard it here first. Ben Wheatley, Martial Law film.
I don't know if the world's ready for Martial Law. You know, and probably more like the first run of Martial Law, that first book is so brilliant. Even like it's weird. It's such a weird comic, that, because even the first, it changed after the first issue almost.
Yeah.
Because the art is completely different on the second issue. It's different. He paints it in a very different way, and it starts to become more poppy almost straight away. But that first issue is really dark. Really unbelievably dark.
I don't think you could say that any of Martial Law is particularly light and fluffy, though.
Well, it gets more fluffy as it goes on, and it gets sillier. But the beginning of it's just like, whoa. It's like Taxi Driver. It's Taxi Driver meets comics, isn't it? I mean, superheroes.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I don't know if the world is ready for somebody who just shoots superheroes.
It's like, what is it that he... I pray for my victims, I pray they go to hell. Yeah. I think that's pretty good. And then they have to, the police station is hidden, so no one can find it. But it's just genius, all that. You know?
It took me years to... Because I read a bit of Martial Law in Toxic, the short-lived comic in the very early 90s. And it took me ages to work out that was barbed wire that was wrapped around his biceps. I was like, what, is that some really funny tattoo? What are those lines? Oh, now I understand. I think there was a poster where Kevin O'Neill did like a really mega close-up on his arm. I was like, that's barbed wire.
Yeah, but he's also living with that woman, isn't he? How did she not notice that his arm was bleeding every time he came home from work, you know? Yeah, shouldn't dig too deeply into it, I don't think.
As a filmmaker, what did you make of the 2012 Dread movie?
Yeah, I liked it, yeah. I thought it was great. I mean, I think, you know, with comics and film, there is a... People underestimate the difference between the mediums, you know. Mm. And I always have a problem with comic adaptation, like really straight, the more straight ones, like the ones that are kind of frame for frame the same, specifically Sin City and Watchmen. Mm. And it's that when you do it like that, it really highlights the difference between the two mediums, and that comics are not storyboards, you know. There's something, the fact that you read and look at pictures and you read it in a non-linear way often, back to front, flipping across different pages, and then you back and you savour a moment again, and then it's all part of the experience of a comic. And it's not, and in a movie is fiercely linear, you know, and oftentimes that means that the pace of a comic, you know, it feels a lot slower in your mind, but when you're literally shown it on film, it zips by too quick, and it doesn't feel like the comic does, even if it's exactly the same, you know. So when they did I thought the Dread film managed to get around that, you know, because it felt much more grounded. And but I think, I don't know, but there's something about Dredd himself. This was just something to do with comics as well, where you know, when you draw a superhero, their outfit seems right in their world because the style of the drawing of the costume is the same as the backgrounds. Mm. But when you try and replicate those costumes in real life, they can look unstuck. And I thought that, you know, there's something, the things I really like about Dredd, you can't replicate at all, you know. And like, these costumes, like, there's something about it. And the fact that all the artists draw it completely differently as well, it's just fantastic.
There was a great quote from a guy called Chris Sims, who writes for the Comic Alliance website, way back at when we first started this podcast, where we were talking about Dredd's costume and how in American superhero, well, in most comics actually, you want to boil the silhouette down to, you know, the absolute basics to make it as recognisable as possible. So you've got the, you know, you've got the Superman emblem and you've got the cape and you've got the Batman ears and the symbol and everything. But with Judge Dredd, it's just insane. It's like they took that rule, like Square took that rule and completely tore it up, and people have been tearing it up ever since. So, you know, the more outlandish. I mean, now, you know, you get somebody like Colin McNeil,
yeah,
who, you know, absolutely fantastic, but the shoulder pads and the knee pads are just so huge. You think, how do any of them move? Never mind fight crime.
Well, look, it used to confuse me as a kid because the knee pad colours would change.
Oh, yes.
They're yellow and green, depending on which artist. The Lawmaster, you used to get a different one out every week. You know, you go, is that the Mark II or the Mark I? These things are important to children, you know.
Absolutely.
You kind of pore over the... And because comics, again, because you can get them all out and look at them, you know, you can spread them out on the floor and look at, you know, which I used to do, or like you get them together and you get one story and you stack them all up, open at that story and then go through them. And it's, you know, you really, and that gave me a lot of training in terms of when I came to read Watchmen.
Mm.
I was ready, primed for that comic, you know, from reading 2000 AD and the detail that was in it.
It's always slightly baffled me. I mean, I've done this myself where people say, oh, you know, I don't read comics, what should I read? And you kind of almost automatically go, oh, you should read Watchmen. But then you think about the sheer complexity of that story and how much visual information Dave Gibbons fits into every single panel. I think that's advanced comic book reading.
Yeah. I mean, I remember I read that. I read it at the time and we over the year and got it issue by issue.
Mm.
And every issue blew our minds. You know, I remember just reading it, and you'd read it first in the coffee shop, and your hand would be shaking reading it. It was quite insane. And then I remember going to a talk that Alan Moore did at the ICA, and I would have been, I don't know, whatever, 13 or 14 or something.
Mm.
And I knew that the they'd been taken from the characters like the Atom and the Question and all that.
Mm.
And at the end it was an open question thing, and I had my hand up because I was going to furiously accuse Moore of copying them. even though I loved the comic like an absolute little idiot, and I was going to out him as a plagiarist. And I luckily didn't get asked question. Thank God. I think I'd still be shivering with shame about that to this day if I'd have managed to do that, you know.
Oh, fantastic. So, I mean, in terms of 2000 AD, as a director, are there any properties that you remember enjoying that you think you would be able to bring to the screen? Is there one that kind of jumps out and you go, actually, that's the kind of thing I could see adapting?
Yeah, well, I think Fiends, the Eastern Front, is one that you could make into a film. It's quite straightforward, that one. The Harry 20 and the High Rock one is definitely really, is because it's such a contained story.
Yeah.
I think Strontium Dog, The Killing, is one that makes sense as a film.
Mm.
You know, because it's all in there. It's very simple setup. It's loads of action. It's really funny. Those ones I thought about. I mean, yeah, maybe the one I used to really like is Invasion.
Oh yeah.
I think it might be a bit slightly racist.
Well, I'm just about to say, I'm not sure the world's ready for a xenophobic lorry driver, high Tory voting.
It's a film basically about it's a conversation you have with a cabbie, only made flesh, isn't it? With a shotgun.
With a shotgun.
With them all storming out of the Channel Tunnel. I mean, that was high science fiction when I read it the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but the the Volgs, wherever they come from. The Volgs are quite put upon, aren't they, in the 2000 AD timeline?
Yeah, well, as Pat has kind of brought Invasion and the ABC Warriors together into the same universe. Yeah, they're basically the generic bad guy. I mean, they're a Russian analogue. It's just that they couldn't call them Russians at the time because it was, I don't know, somebody at IPC thought that perhaps it would start in the Third World.
It's a rare taste, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, it's that... it's that moment where they nuke either Birmingham or Manchester. I can't remember which one at the beginning of. It's like one of the opening gambit. You know, they're parachuting down onto the BT tower.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
BBC Four.
Yeah.
Stopping all the documentaries going out about the '60s about Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, and then they lob a nuke at a city for no apparent reason because they've already captured London. It's just even as a, I mean, I was a teenager when I read that stuff in Collection, and even at the time I was thinking, God, this is hard stuff.
And what's the one that is it? Then it floods, doesn't it? England floods.
Yeah, that's Disaster 1990, I think.
Yeah, but then doesn't it kind of almost come back as Tower King in the Eagle when they redo the Eagle?
Oh, because
Tower King's quite good when they all the electricity runs out and they all go medieval.
I just love that principle. That's great. All the electricity runs out.
Yeah, because it's some kind of, was it a satellite goes wrong?
Right.
It's just bizarre, you know. I didn't mind the Eagle as well. I think I collected that for quite a long time. That was... It shared writers, didn't it, as well?
Yeah, one or two people crossed over, I think. That was something that... a bit like 2000 AD with you. I could regularly get 2000 AD, but the coverage of the new Eagle was spotty.
Yeah.
So I think I had a copy of that from a trip to France. I think I bought it on the cross-channel ferry, and that was the only time I got to see the new Dandare stuff.
That was that and Scream as well, wasn't it? It's funny, because my comic collecting mates now, so they're really dredging the barrel, so... Now they've done up Scream, and I think they're moving on to the girls' comics.
Yeah,
there's nothing else left to buy, you know.
We're reprinting Monster from Scream. I wanted to talk to you about Ian McRabane.
Yes,
because you explain that as an alternative history of Britain with armoured vehicles and misery and police control, inspired by 2000 AD, and starring Nick Frost as a fat Peter Pan. Do you want to explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're still playing around with it, so it's kind of moved on a bit since then. But I think there's definitely elements of 2000 AD in it, in its kind of anarchy and violence and comedy elements of it. But yeah, if we were to say what I've actually nicked directly from 2000 AD in the work would be, I did a series called Wrong Door.
Yeah.
On BBC Three. And the episode, my favourite episode of that, the one that I did the most writing on, was, I think it's the fifth episode, with the train pirates in it.
Yeah.
And the end of the, but part of that is like this woman who feeds planes that are like birds. And that's all Nick from Kilowatt.
Yeah, Nemesis the Warlock.
Yeah, so that the last thing of that is the train being attacked by this massive, by a 747, and who takes it off like a worm. And that's directly from from Kilowatt, from the end of it, I think. Or is it the beginning? Anyway, so there's a big bird plane thing feeding a train to someone.
Yeah, it's a view of the surface of Earth when that's testing my memory.
Book Armada's trying to get the bomb. Yeah, his plane's crashed, isn't it? And he comes down an egg or something, and and he's trying to get home, and he goes by the cable rather than by the train because the train's been destroyed by the bird.
It's really good. When I was a teenager, I'd want to come up with my own comics, and I'd read something either in 2000 AD or I was reading Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. You know, I'd get random issues of that, and I'd look and say, "Oh, that's really, really good." And then I'd put it in my comics and think that no one would ever notice. I basically just lifted this thing from these incredibly popular and opinion forming comics.
Well, this was definitely a swipe. It wasn't. I didn't look at it and then thought it was my own idea. This was just thieving. But no one seemed to say anything about it. I was very proud of it. I was thinking, well, you know, I don't think much of this stuff. I mean, apart from Hardware.
Oh yeah.
I don't think anything else had been lifted so directly as that. But yeah, no, I was very chuffed with that.
I mean, with the Wrong Door. Obviously, each episode had a new idea behind it, a new concept. Did that idea of episodic storytelling appeal to you, where it's a one and done?
Well, it was meant to be a thing which was a complete world, and it kind of got mangled as we made it, unfortunately. But that was like the first thing I'd ever done where I'd had a modicum of control. So, it didn't go as well as it does. But it was all meant to interlink, you know, and it was meant to, you know, you see characters appear across the whole thing, and there was going to be, it's meant to be a bigger story. But then it was that met the kind of idea of the day, which was catchphrase comedy, and it was around the same time as just after Little Britain, so that made a massive imprint on everything. It was comedy stuff that was made for telly. I mean, I'm quite proud of some of Wrong Door. He's a very mean show, which you might be able to draw lines between that and 2008. I think there's a lot of meanness, a lot of cruelty to small animals and children get killed quite a lot in it, and then it's kind of quite high concept-y, sci-fi-y stuff in it. That we got away with, which I was really surprised about. But then there's an element of BBC-ness to it, which is a bit, you know, but rubbed all the edges off stuff. And also just wasn't up to scratch with the fighting, so that suffered a bit too. But, you know, but for me, it was massively, you know, affected everything I did from that point on, because I met all the actors that I used later on in all the other movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So Mianna Buring, Michael Smiley, Maskell, and all those guys, you know, they all met them on that. So that really made a big difference. And also kind of I cut my teeth on doing special effects on that as well. So that was a real eye-opener.
I mean, talking about the sort of mean kind of comedy of the Wrong Door. All of your films are, if not exactly funny throughout, and certainly threaded with a dark, cynical humour. I mean, you know, I love the bit in Sightseers where she shoves the guy off the cliff in his little
carapod
thing. And it's horrible and it's terrible, but it's funny as well. I mean, like, say, is that a line direct from 2000 AD that it basically influenced this dark humour?
I'd say so. With that and Python, you know.
Yeah.
And I think around that period, my first experience of Python was getting like a cassette.
Oh God, yeah, exactly. I was exactly the same. Just listening to the sketches that have been adapted for essentially radio.
Yeah, it's really weird. You kind of it sounds weird now because obviously everything's available all the time. Mm. So the idea of something being hard to get hold of, I mean, the whole story of Python, where there was only shown, I think it was only repeated twice, and then they had to go on tour with it.
Mm.
And they did a live tour, and then they made a record, and that was the only way you could get hold of it. And I think that's, so much effort to go into getting hold of it, you know, and that it was on a knife edge whether or not it would become part of culture in a way, you know. But yeah, so I had it on cassette, and then I would have seen the film and now for something completely different. And that was my first experience with comedy where I felt I was going to pass out listening to it, watching it. It's just the funniest thing ever. But having said that, Kenny Everett, we used to, going back to Kilowatt, the first Nemesis thing has Kenny Everett.
Terror Tube
is a little Kenny Everett cameo in it. And I remember watching Kenny Everett with my mum a lot and laughing, thinking it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And I rewatched some of it recently, and it is very good.
So it sounds like there's a butt coming at the end of that sentence.
If a little raw. I think that there's a permission in 2000 AD to do that. That violence is funny, and cruelty, as long as it's serving some kind of satire, is okay. I think it's not cruelty for cruelty's sake, Everett. I don't think in 2000 AD. Doesn't seem to be. Even the fatties. Being a man of a certain weight these days, you know. It's like
we put a collection out in America of the fatty stories from Judge Dredd, and the front cover is that wonderful image of the guy in front of the giant fatty, like, you know, huge guy, just going, "Praise the Lord!" And when we go a couple of times when we've been over to San Diego for Comic-Con, and that's been, like, you know, on the table, and people have come past and reacted really negatively towards it. So, like, that, and you know, that's fat shaming. Yeah, well, it's 30 years old.
Surely they're proud. They're big and
absolutely,
they're proud.
Absolutely, yeah.
What's the one that's their really grim story when he finds them, they're being force fed?
Oh, is that Requiem for Heavyweight?
Yeah, that's it. Oh my God, that's so horrible, that one. Ugh. Remember that. I like the Fink stories as well. You don't see enough Fink.
Fink Angel.
Yeah. The one where they're all in the resc.
Recycle.
Yeah. I would call it resc for years, you know.
Yeah.
There you go. But yeah, when they've been paralyzed, they're all going to, and the machine is in his mouth, about to put his teeth out. I mean, that's just, God, what's that? It's the stuff of nightmares, isn't it?
I mean, when you're doing a film, how important is it to kind of have moments of lightness and comedy? Even if it's dark comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, for starters, real life is generally pretty funny, no matter what's happening, I think. And humour is a reaction to adversity often. And to have characters that aren't funny is unrealistic. And that most people use humour to lighten that stuff. And when you get movies that don't have any laughs in them at all, it's slightly suspicious, and feels not right. It feels like it's lost some kind of humanity, basic humanity to it. So that's why I like it, you know. And generally, either the films are funny or they're comedies or they're characters who have a sense of humour. And I think having a sense of humour is an important makeup of most people. And it's rare that you find someone who's utterly humorless.
You should try working in comics. I can give you a list.
So yeah, it's important, and it's also part of. I think that if when you start to look at what cinema is or used to be in the 40s and 50s, they're kind of like. Those Hollywood movies are made up of little bits of other films all the time. So you've got like a, you know, in a Bogart movie or a, you know, a detective movie or a cowboy movie, they're not ashamed to just stop and have a song and all stand around and play the guitar and sing for a bit and then go back into the story again, because it's, you know, the you often need a break, you know, to get through stuff. So I think that's part of it. And it's just, it doesn't, you know, showing people lots of different types of entertainment isn't necessarily a bad thing.
I mean, there were quite a few British directors. So I'm thinking sort of Edgar Wright, Christopher Nolan, Danny Cannon, who said they've been inspired by 2000 AD in their work. Do you think there are any that have actually delivered on that, that you kind of look at it without necessarily knowing that they're into 2000 AD, you look at their work and you go, yeah, that person gets it?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe Paul Verhoeven, through Ed Neumeier.
Right, yeah.
I think he's the one who's influenced by 2000 AD, definitely. I mean, Robocop is Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
But Robocop's also Dark Knight Returns, oddly, when you look at it. There's scenes directly from the comic in it.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's interesting.
The bit where he busts through the wall and grabs the guy is really similar to the sequence.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
In Dark Knight. Who's it in the... Yeah, and also all the TV screens are very similar, aren't they? The TV news and stuff in Robocop's very similar to Dark Knight Returns. But yeah, I mean, that's almost the most 2008, outside of Hardware, the most 2000 AD film ever made, I think, is Robocop, to a degree. I mean, Dredd obviously is, but there's something about the attitude of Robocop, which is the mixture of comedy and satire and science fiction, which seems spot on.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I remember, and it's been a while since this, I wrote a feature about the connection between Robocop and Dredd, and how there's some suggestion and some evidence that they wanted to make a Judge Dredd film. Because
helmet looks the same, wasn't it? There was designs for the helmet.
Yeah. And you know, with lines like,
Dead or Alive, you're coming with me.
Yeah, Dead or Alive, coming with me. But what's the one?
Your move, creep.
Or there'll be trouble. What's that line from Robocop?
I don't know.
Put your guns down, or there'll be trouble.
Yeah,
it's almost a direct lift from one of the Cursed Earth covers, where Dredd's got like 40 or 50 guns pointing at him, and it's, you know, usual Dredd bravado, come quietly. There we go.
A gun that fires heat-seeking bullets, isn't it? Yeah. Which I found, I played the Judge Dredd role-playing game when I was a kid, which was completely broken by the heat-seeking bullets. You couldn't, every situation you go, hot shot. Yeah, okay, they're all dead. Hot shot, okay, they're all dead. And the end, I had to make villains made of fire to stop, you know, to stop it, draw the bullets away from people. Anyway, sorry. I press.
No, I think it's been fascinating to hear how, how formative 2000 AD was. Kids kind of develop the way of reading stories and how they interpret stories at a relatively young age. Mm. And here you are, you've got John Wagner, Alan Grant, Jerry Finley Day, Pat Mills, kind of blasting your brain away. And that's, you know, really, aside from the TV, that's your main source of entertainment and storytelling.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're telling a variety of stories as a director. Can you sort of lay, I was going to say the blame, but is there a line from, you know, reading 2000 AD as a kid and being a storyteller as a director now?
Yeah, well, I think on a very basic level, it made me interested in drawing and art, and like looking at the different art and realizing they're drawn by different people. That's the difference between that and Victor. You know, when you read Victor, even though they're definitely different artists, it all looks the same. Same with Commando, to a degree. I'm probably committing heresy saying this, but everything looks very similar. Those kinds of 50s and 60s comics. Maybe Frank Hampson's different, obviously, because that stuff looks like nothing else. But then when you get 2000 AD, which is all radically different, each strip is completely different to the next one. And then you follow the artist through and you start going, oh, it's that guy and that guy. And then I started drawing and copying them.
Mm.
And then I started drawing my own strips, you know, and my own dread strips and then my own completely different strips. And I would, you know, my mate Dom, who I collected comics with when I was at school, and, you know, and he's a massive collector now still, you know, and we drew and he would write them and I'd draw them. And then I just end up drawing loads of comic strips, like from the age of, I don't know, from the age of 9 through to the age of 17. Just drew all day long, every day, thousands of pages of stuff. And I was never good enough, but it certainly was the beginning of wanting to, you know, after I'd had that practice of drawing all that sequential art, I knew that I wanted to make films.
Mm.
And so that's a direct thing, you know, that's not got twisting it to make it fit because I'm on the 2018 podcast. that's an actual fact, you know. And also the other thing, I met Brett Ewins when I was a kid, and I went to his flat, and around the time they were doing Strange Days, and he'd just done Haunting of Sector House.
Sector House 9.
Why not 13?
Yeah.
Their hands must have hovered over the keyboard at that point not to do 13. Anyway, that was really inspiring. You know, I kind of, to the first time I'd ever met a cartoonist, and I loved his art. And then to see Johnny Nemo and all that stuff just blew my mind, you know. And I wanted to, and it felt really exciting, you know, and it was like a vibrant and alive and possible. And I think that was massive. But then recently I've been working with Mick McMahon as well.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, which is an absolute dream come true. so yeah, we've been doing storyboards together for some of the films.
Okay.
So that's just amazing, you know. And that's like proper grown-up Christmas when stuff comes through from him. Just go, my God, there it is. You know.
So which films are you working on with him?
Well, he did a full set of storyboards for Freak Shift, which we're still working on.
Right.
So there's like 900 drawings.
Wow.
That he did, which are just genius, you know. And you look at it, it's like the film. You just can... There's no dialogue in it, but it's pure kind of kinetic action stuff.
Mm.
And Freak Shift's a film that's about a city which is under siege from monsters that burrow up through the ground at night. And the police force are basically women or people who've committed crimes who are then forced. You get the choice of going on the Freak Shift or being... sent to prison.
Right.
So you do 2 weeks on the Freak Shift or you do your sentence. And the women are all there because it was positive discrimination. They were being hired for the police force, but they got stitched up.
Right.
And sent to this police force that exists only at night. So it's that, and you know, and it's a shift and they go out and fight the monsters and then the shift ends.
And this with Mick McMahon,
yeah.
Story, but wow,
yeah. So there's that, and then another thing, a secret project I can't tell you about. But if I did, you'd be so excited.
Oh, okay.
But I can't say what it is.
All right.
But it's really good. it's good, and I hope it happens. But yeah, he's been doing concept art on that. So yeah, and I think he's going to work with me on the Wages of Fear remake as well that we're doing.
Oh wow! Okay.
So he's going to board all that as well. So yeah, we've been working together on and off for the last couple of years.
Oh, that's fantastic. I wondered why he'd stopped blogging recently. He's clearly been busy.
yeah. So that's all been, that's cool.
Did you succumb to any kind of hero worship? Was there a kind of geek out moment where you were like, "Oh, what can we be, my man?"
I could keep it under control. I met Alan Moore a couple of years ago, and that was pretty difficult to keep my Cool. So yeah, no, I came around. Mick came around and we did our business and talked about what we were going to do, and then I got him to sign a load of 2000 CDs. Shocking behaviour. Yeah, quite a lot of cursed earth ones. I was very chuffed.
Yeah, well, we're publishing the whole cursed earth for the first time.
With the stuff that was banned at the time.
Yeah, which is...
copyrighty stuff. Yeah, I picked all that up the other day, the actual issues for, like, pence.
Oh, right. Somebody did complain to us, I think when they were unsubscribing from our email newsletter, that they were disgusted that the pristine copies of the banned episodes that they had on their wall were now nothing but chip paper, because we were being... Like, okay. Sorry.
What do people want?
Yeah.
No, they're great issues, those. I mean, yeah. And they're a beautiful thing to have. I mean, the McDonald's one is brilliant, you know.
But we had some of the original artwork in the office. someone had very nicely lent it to us so that we could scan it in and, you know, have nice sort of crisp lines and everything. And it still blows me away. I mean, you know, I have a collection of original artwork from 2000 AD. But those pages back from the 1980s, 70s and 80s, absolutely blow me away because they're just perfect.
Yeah.
I remember seeing a Ron Smith original for the first time, which is the Black Atlantic storyline.
Oh God, yeah.
And you've got that kind of opening shot of the big kind of solar barge with that huge sail supposedly made up of solar panels, and you know, you go right up to it and you can't see any hint of a pencil.
How did he do? Because Ron Smith stuff always looked really shiny. Did he do lots of Tippex and stuff on it, or is that all those highlights all drawn in? Are they?
As far as I recall, they're all drawn in.
Oh,
Well, he's still with us, but you know, when he was drawing, he was an absolute master. It's really incredible stuff.
Yeah, I really loved his stuff. Certainly, the Judge Child bits was the first time I saw his work, and that, you know, the Fargo stuff is bonkers.
The only 2000 AD artist to have been a Spitfire pilot during the war.
Ah, because he did a lot of covers for Commando as well, didn't he?
Yeah,
it's a painting of like gouache stuff.
I mean, he's in his late 80s now, I think. He was just at the tail end of the war. He was a Spitfire pilot, and then he ended up being an animator for Rank Studios.
Oh, right.
Cool. And then they went under, and because I interviewed him a few years ago, and he said, you know, the guy came from Rank and said, basically, you're all being let go because the studio is closing. And he said, the union guy said, you know, nobody leave, you know, we'll sort this out, we'll get you jobs, and sod this. Packed his suitcase and went to London and walked into the offices of, I think it was IPC, and basically went, oh, I'm here for a job.
I can draw.
Yeah. And they hired him, and you know, the rest was history. So it was really a really fascinating insight into a world that's completely gone now. You know, you don't have that kind of studio system that they used to back in the 40s and 50s. So
well, it's interesting. I've been doing research into Eagle and like the, you know, that whole thing of them locking them in a house, didn't they, and kind of making them draw like a. And that's kind of unique, wasn't it, Eagle, where they would build all the models and take all the photographs and then kind of reconstruct it from that rather than... I mean, I suppose Bolland is the only one who's closer to that. Is that right? He's a lot of his stuff's from photos, isn't it?
I don't know how Brian worked at the time, because he's all digital now.
Right.
In the stuff that he does. But he does have that kind of photographic... feel to his work, you know.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot of characters are from classic movies as well, aren't they, in the backgrounds of stuff you can see. You can link the photos around. Certainly in the earlier stuff, I definitely saw that.
And of course,
I was cleaning out my shed the other day and I found, which I was very happy to find, was a Forbidden Planet Bolland bag.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I was like, oof, that's good.
Yeah, there aren't that many of those left anymore. It's all kind of gone the way of all flesh.
I see. I was in New York last week, and they have Forbidden Planet in New York still has the Bolland artwork on outside of the building, which is quite nice. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Ben, we've been chatting for an hour and a half, so I don't want to kind of impose.
Yeah, I mean, you know, woe betide anyone who's managed to get to the end of this.
Alert! 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 Full power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Be 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.